The killing of seven aid workers in the Gaza Strip with World Central Kitchen, the charity. We're now hearing from Cyprus that the aid ships that have been travelling from Cyprus into Gaza, of course, this was a big development for those in Gaza that the aid was able to come in that way. Aid ships are now being turned around, still carrying aid. 240 tonnes of undelivered aid is now heading back to Cyprus because of this attack on a car, killing seven aid workers, because the charity obviously unloading the ship and distributing that aid in Gaza. World Central Kitchen, one of those charities involved, has now suspended its operations because of this apparent Israeli airstrike. We'll bring you more.
Welcome, everybody. Left Reckoning 163. My name is David Grishkin, and I'm broadcasting to you live, bringing in right now my good friend Matt Leck, co-host of the program. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing okay, David. Good to be with you, though.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of a wild ride here. I mean, we are going to be watching in just a second some of the most egregious brutal cover-ups for the continued slaughter of Palestinians by Israel, and there's just an aspect to it where it becomes sort of laughable to a certain extent, right? Because it just is so egregious and so in your face. But yes, it is absolutely devastating. The context here.
Yeah, just to decode that, some of the things in that news piece there, which I think conveyed some of the horror, but just a few things. When they say aid, they mean food and water. World Central Kitchen, yeah, that's food. These people are starving to death. And apparent Israeli airstrike, it was three. It was three strikes, three different times, three different locations of the same convoy of people. What's wild is trying to convey the actual sort of abject evil that we are seeing now. And, we have our spokespeople just barely getting over the line in trying to launder it into something acceptable.
And again, people make this point a lot on the left, but it's like, that kind of passive voice here in that news clip we just played, where it's like, oh, some folks were killed. Well, killed by who? And it's like at a certain point, there isn't a refusal. There's been a refusal for a long time to sort of acknowledge what's going on in the first place. And now it just is so in your face. It's undeniable. There's just a lot of attempts to kind of divert blame or muddy the water. I mean, this has been from the get-go from early Israeli airstrikes into Gaza to something like this, which again, let's not forget, the recent news, the recent images of what happened at that hospital, just an unbelievable rampage of violence, hatred, and inhumanity committed by Israel against the Palestinian people. But this is just, I think, a very clear example of just how brazen Israel has been, continues to be, and the refusal from the Americans, from the American government at least, to acknowledge what is going on. So just, maybe just to set the table a little bit for folks who are unfamiliar, who don't have the complete story, what happened here is an organization set up by celebrity chef Jose Andreas, that we'll get to in a second, the connections there to DC, was doing the human work of providing food for Palestinian people who continued to face an onslaught of genocide, attempts to starve them out. And if that's not enough, bombs constantly being dropped on them, along with brutality from foot soldiers in the IDF. Now, these food trucks, these trucks delivering food, went in to a predetermined location that had been approved by the IDF, right? So this is not something where people were sort of operating under their own, under their own organization. No, they go to the IDF, they say, hey, we have food that we're going to deliver to the starving people. We're going to go to this location. We're going to take this route. We're going to be here from this time to that time, and then we're going to come back. These aid workers followed that to the letter. what it was that they told the IDF that they were going to be doing along the route that the IDF told them to take, right? There's not a mistake. Oh, we took a scenic route or we took a right when we shouldn't have. This group of people were on the path that had already been approved by the IDF. The IDF knew who they were. They knew where they were. And they knew what time they were supposed to be at the places that they were, right? So, you know, any kind of thing of like, oh, maybe they got confused about this or that. They had the information about where this group was. So on the return journey, after they had delivered this food, the IDF, they were, this group of people were bombed. Not once, not twice, but three times. And there's been some images that have come out since. I don't want to, you know, overdo it with some of these gruesome images, but just to sort of, you know, make clear to folks what we're talking about, the scale of damage here. Here is an image of one of these trucks. As you can see here very clearly, a massive crater at the top of it. That happened not, again, not once, not twice, but three times. And despite all of this destruction, there's something that should be noted that's very, very clear here, is that on top of all of these trucks, absolutely clear, undeniable, even with all of this damage, there is the symbol of the World Kitchen here that is, you know, set up so that Israel did not do.
Why did that have to be there? Why did they have to put that on top? And it didn't matter. I mean, clearly the reason they put on is what everybody knows, which is that Israel will take any excuse to bomb a vehicle. And yet, doesn't matter. They did it anyway and hit it right on the money.
Yeah.
Because
it was a precision strike.
They don't care. Exactly.
I mean, to point that out, I mean, like that. This is target acquired, right? You know, think about the video there. It's like, boom, zoomed in. Here's where exactly where it's going. And that's where it went. So yeah, this is not shrapnel. This is not, you know, fallout or anything like that. This was a deliberate strike here. Now, I mean, we know why Israel did it. We'll play some clips from the United States government in a second. But let's just note two real quick things as we're setting the table here. What's the reaction? Rightfully, people are furious about it. But what's the secondary reaction been? Well, Jose Andres, out of fear for the safety of these people who are putting themselves in harm's way, has said that they're going to suspend operations in the area. And on top of that, a whole host of other charity organizations, food organizations, groups that are trying to deliver aid to the people of Gaza have said that they're going to suspend operations. You know, think very clearly here the kind of mission is for Israel. They bombed these people who were feeding Gazans, and now less food's going into Gaza.
There's another what's the message to a Gazan who's able to follow this? Let's say they have access to internet or communications, right? No more food, right? Also, we're going to make sure that other groups aren't going to bring food because they're fearful of their life. And also, look what we can do. We can just bomb the aid that's coming in, and the world and the United States won't say nothing. Maybe, you know, say, oh, they're upset about this. They won't stop this kind of shit. We run the air. We can act indiscriminately because we have protection from the United States of America to continue in your mass slaughter.
But David, Brian Schatz, senator, I believe senator, he's a senator, right? He's a whole ass senator from mm-hmm. Hawaii. This is just so devastating. One of the most careful, caring, undeniably virtuous organizations. First of all, Brian Schatz, as Stephen Semler, who's a great follow on these issues, pointed out, Semler voted for, or Schatz voted to give Israel $3.8 billion in unconditional military aid. He also voted for Biden's foreign aid bill, which gives $14.1 billion. And, you know, I'd also point out, as people will point out, as others will, $185,000 from Israel and the pro-Israel lobby. And, like, I also feel like it's worth going back to the fact that when people think of AIPAC, mm-hmm. It's worth going back to the history there of, like, is it just to support, a Jewish homeland following the Holocaust? Well, it was actually formed a little bit after that. And here is a guy, Doug Rosenau, in the Washington Post, which is, you know, comparative to the New York Times has been better, which is not to say good on Israel-Palestine. But anyway, the dark roots of AIPAC, America's pro-Israel lobby. A group was formed to spin positive PR after Israeli atrocities, Rosna writes. But on October 15th, 1953, all hell broke loose. News spread that an Israeli army unit had struck into the Jordanian-occupied West Bank and committed a massacre in the Palestinian village of Kibya, killing more than 60 civilians indiscriminately in retaliation for the murder of a Jewish woman and her two children in Israel on the night of October 12th. The Time magazine carried a shocking account of deliberate, even casual mass murder by Israeli soldiers in Kibya, slouching, smoking, and joking. The New York Times ran extensive excerpts from a UN commission that refuted Israeli lies about the incident. Israel's most active U.S. supporters realized how severe the danger of damage to Israel was. Karen Kennan wrote of the ill effect of Kibya on what he called our propaganda. After Kibya, Dulles confirmed for the first time, Alan Dulles confirmed that Washington was holding up aid to Israel. The United States supported a censure of Israel in the UN Security Council. U.S. aid soon resumed after Israel pledged it would stop its work at the controversial water diversion site. And, you know, I would recommend that piece just generally because this is what AIPAC does. It buys our politicians silence about massacres, and it's been doing it since the 50s. And so when Brian Schatz gets in here, and despite voting for policy that it keeps these bombs flowing and these arms flowing to Israel, cries crocodile tears for these dead people, it's a fucking performance, and it is getting really difficult to continue to swallow.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, it is tremendously clear here that it's absolutely absurd for someone to be sitting in the United States government, crying crocodile tears as this is ongoing when it could not go on without the United States role here. Like, this is not a passive relationship is the point. It's not just like, oh, we want a symbolic statement from a group of senators to stand out and say this. No, the United States government has a material relationship with the state of Israel, and particularly and most importantly right now with the military of Israel. We shouldn't be giving them weapons in the first place, right?
No.
But these people don't even have the temerity, the balls, whatever you want to call it, to say we're going to have conditioned aid. If the United States is going to provide you with military equipment, with military training, with military expertise, you will not use that to slaughter innocent women and children and aid workers, members of our own country, right? No. That's not what we get. We get, oh man, this is so sad. As if they're just sort of watching and, you know, oh, I'm bearing witness to this tragedy. You participate in the mass slaughter of Gazans. This is American policy here. Yep.
I mean, like, look, like all this stuff is performance, because when they actually get to vote on bills that cite budget priorities, it's defund UNRWA. Why is World Central Kitchen even relied on to get food into this place? It's because America decided we're going to pass a budget that says these people who feed Palestinians are terrorists. Actually, we agree with Israel on that. Yeah, there is no. It's interesting. We had a Nell Schielein on, who recently resigned from the State Department on Majority Today over, you know, the support for Israel. And she made an interesting point, which is that actually there are people within the State Department who would have the work ready to go if we want to start enforcing human rights on Israel, if we want to actually take a different tack. That work, we actually have a huge bureaucracy and people actually, you know, spend some time on that sort of thing. But it's not going to happen because of Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. It's at the top. He is stopping certain avenues of policy from being explored, diplomacy from being explored, and entrenching one that supports genocide, that covers his party in blood, and we're supposed to fight fascism. Look, I agree about Project 2025. Like I think the downplaying of that, like, it's not super convincing to me, but also the come join with us in support of a Holocaust across the globe to fight fascism at home. It doesn't work for me. You can't do that. You can't invoke fascism and support what's going on in Israel right now. It's disgusting. It's clearly like meant to actually short circuit it. So I don't know. Like we are on a slope downward towards a lot of that stuff. And, you know, Biden and the folks who want to make apologies for that are as responsible as anybody.
Yeah. And, you know, so I'll just note really quick here, you know, that Joe Biden did call Jose Andreas after the killing of those aid workers. I mean, I guess Joe Biden said he was sorry that those bombs were actually meant for children. Sorry that they hit those aid workers. I mean, truly a joke in to even be talking like this. Just something to note for people who aren't as familiar with DC that, like, it does matter a bit that this is Jose Andreas. Jose Andreas is somebody who, you know, doesn't have the best politics, and also locally in DC is somebody who has sort of waged war on restaurant workers, fought against fair wages for them in order to keep the nasty tipped wage and low minimum wage for workers, right? So I'm not the biggest fan of Jose Andreas. This stuff, you know, going and taking care of people and feeding people, that's good, you know, human work. I won't get into any of that kind of stuff right now. But what does matter and has been pointed out by a few folks is that Jose Andreas in a city that is built around wine and happy hour and late night dinners, Jose Andreas is a god. He is somebody who has, you know, some of the biggest restaurants in DC. He's somebody who powerful people like to be around. They like to frequent his places. So the fact that this happened to Jose Andreas's group might matter, which is so perverse to think about it. That DC might start to move on this, not because of their hearts, but because of their stomachs. But
Upton Sinclair, sort of special for right there.
But, we'll see, because every time you think that maybe something will move these schools, you will be disappointed very, very quickly. Now, in the interest of time, Matt, we have clips from, our two boys, but I think you should pick which one we would like to see.
Let's go with Kirby. Kirby is just a slapstick clown of genocide. I think Matt Miller, whatever his name is, he's less obviously cartoonish.
So this is a clip here that I think is important here, and this is from Halal Flow, also a great Twitter follow as well. This is from earlier today, where Kirby is basically challenged on this idea that, you know, Israel is supposed to have this hyper precise technology, right? That's why it's okay that they can bomb residential neighborhoods because, they hit their target. But also, I guess sometimes they just do a big whoopsie, but also hit a precision strike on the logo of this humanitarian aid organization. But anyway, let's play this clip here and see how he tries to wriggle his way out of this one. I'll do it again. Excuse me.
Kirby, Israel has killed a senior Hamas leader in Beirut with precision weapons in an area where thousands of civilians were there. They killed senior Iranian officials in Damascus, in the heart of Damascus. It was serious, but there were thousands of civilians there as well. Does it make sense to you that a vehicle marked with World Central Kitchen, after coordinating with the Israelis, that they didn't see it? And doesn't this debunk your theory and defense of Israel that it is difficult for them because Hamas embedded with the civilian population, where they can go after Hamas leaders in the heart of a civilian population in Beirut and in Damascus?
To your second question, no, it's not my theory. I have talked about, I've talked about this for months now. Fighting in an urban, highly populated, condensed environment like that's tough. But they have taken strikes against Hamas leaders and successfully taken strikes against Hamas leaders in Gaza. I can't speak to what happened in Damascus. That I can only tell you that the United States wasn't involved. So I'm not going to talk about the details of that whatsoever. I'm telling you that they have taken precise strikes against Hamas in Gaza. They have also taken strikes that have been not precise. It looks as if very clearly what happened yesterday is one of those examples. They'll investigate that. And our expectation is, and we've made this clear to them, that they'll come clean about what they've learned. They'll be fully transparent. And if people need to be held accountable, that they'll be held accountable.
For sure. For sure.
What did you learn? What did you learn?
I can't wait till that investigation is done. Israel really will get to the bottom of that. And just a reminder, it was three times.
Yeah.
The vehicles, I mean, I'll pull up the, I should actually pull up the thing. Like the Haaretz very explicitly talks about, let's see if I have that.
Man, I think it like getting that timeline, right for folks who aren't like getting it set, like, yeah, again, this wasn't like one strike or, you know, missile fail or something like that. This was one, two, three, right? You know, the time in between. So this was something that was planned. This was not something that was just a kind of spur of the moment. And again, as you saw in that image we showed y'all earlier, that was a precision strike through the top of the vehicle. So, you know, to sit here, yeah.
Here, I'll make this up big here. A few minutes later, the three cars left the warehouse without the truck on which the ostensibly armed man was located. Ostensibly, you know, oh, we saw a guy with a gun. According to the defense sources, the armed man did not leave the warehouse. The cars traveled along a route pre-approved and coordinated with the IDF. At some point when the convoy is driving along the approved route, the war room of the unit responsible for the security of the route ordered the drone operators to attack one of the cars with a missile. Some of the passengers were seen leaving the car after it was hit and switching to one of the other two cars. They continued to drive and even notified the people responsible that they were attacked. But seconds later, another missile hit the car, hit their car. And I'll just scroll up a little bit here.
Jesus Christ. I mean, what tremendous horror. Yeah.
The third car in the convoy approached and the passengers began to transfer to it. The wounded who had survived the second strike in order to get them out of danger, but then a third missile struck them. All seven World Central Kitchen volunteers were killed in that strike. So, I mean, you know, it's just murder.
Yeah. And again, you have to pick your lane. This is something that you learn in media too. It's like sometimes you sort of have to pick your position on things. And it's either that, you know, Israel operates an incredibly precise, well-oiled a military machine, or it is just indiscriminately killing people. And to sit here and be like, they can be precise when they're firing into a neighborhood. Yeah. But also, on pre-approved routes, for aid workers. No, you know, it is one of those things where it's an insult to the American people. It's an insult, certainly to the Palestinians and to the globe. Just the way that these folks lie, you know, and truly, you know, to talk about the Trump Biden thing. I mean, how many years of, oh, I can't believe this has been said at an official American, you know, press conference, right? You know, what happened to the sanctity? You were watching the Democratic Party and the Biden administration stomp on any value of democracy, of having the government be accountable to the people. I mean, it is an insult to you, the viewer, to you, the American citizen, when you see American officials go up there and lie in the way that they have been doing during this conflict.
Yeah, it's you know, it's something we've always said, even before when the Biden administration was just getting in, like, look, these spokespeople are liars. They are paid liars. Every administration, you know, you should not, they're not worse because they work for Trump, right? But even I gotta say, like, and I'm sure like the Vietnam era, you had some real doozy press conferences going on there. Mm-hmm. But this is really, I think, a low point for even that disgraceful position.
Well, you know, we'll keep on covering this. I think that all the folks out there who have been working on showing up and challenging the Biden administration are doing good and important work. And I think, you know, continuing that fight is something that is extremely important for us to be engaged in right now.
Yeah. Shout out to the people who have gotten Karine Jean-Pierre's face. So it's especially good with her because, you know, it hurts because she's criticized Israel before being, you know, part of the sort of state. You see people like that, get your phone up and harass them. That's like the very least that you possibly do.
Well, I think we might pop over to our interview with Matt Huber. And I'll just say this before going in, to this. Some folks have asked me, why do we spend, time or so much time on questions like degrowth? Because, I think it's worthwhile interacting with ideas out there. But more importantly, and the reason why it frustrates and affects me so much is that, you know, a few years ago, I remember when Bernie Sanders announced the Green New Deal policy. We were actually, the three of us, you, me, and Michael, were on our way to Chicago when that briefing dropped. And I just remember being so excited about a kind of policy out there that was doing the work of confronting climate change, trying to fundamentally rework the way Americans interact with energy, but most importantly, doing it in a way that was going to be a marked improvement of the lives of not just, everybody in a holistic way, but specifically for the people who work in extractive and the fossil fuel industry. It was a promise for working class Americans for a better life. It was something that was tremendously inspiring when you saw that inspiration all across, the United States. And then, in fact, the Green New Deal became a rallying cry for left and socialist movements the world over, the idea that we should invest in taking on climate change and do that as a way to rework the economy so that it works for everybody else. That works for the vast majority of us. Fast forward a few years later, folks who just a couple years back recognized that America is a country built on extreme poverty and extreme deprivation for the masses. Just a couple years later, seeing things like, American workers are privileged, sitting on top, living high on the hog, and they need to see their standard of living decline, not improve, and turn their back on a project like the Green New Deal in favor of something that I think is very clearly at this point can be labeled as green austerity. Now, you can say it's a nice austerity or whatever you want, but this is something that is the complete opposite of what the Green New Deal was, what the Green New Deal promised. And, and Saito, who we're going to talk about in a second, literally penned a piece in The Nation magazine calling the Green New Deal the opiate of the masses, right? Now, again, you can disagree with my politics. That's fine, right? But I think that people who have sort of gotten, worked up in this whole degrowth thing, who just a few years ago were saying, I believe in the Green New Deal, I'm going to go knock on doors for the Green New Deal, should ask themselves why they have turned their back on a politics like the Green New Deal and instead embraced a politics like degrowth, which again pits working people oftentimes as the villain, and turns us back on, I think, the more radical and important aspirations that were outlined in the Green New Deal, and I think more broadly in the radical tradition of the socialist movement. But anyways, that's a little preamble. We're going to talk a bit about degrowth, but we're specifically going to spend some time talking about Saito's work that has been translated into English recently. Matt Huber is always great. There are links below to read the review in Jacobin Magazine, Matt Huber and Fred Stafford's new piece in Damage Magazine, which I highly suggest reading that piece and also subscribing to Damage. And if you haven't already, I can't believe if you haven't, but you should be buying Matt Huber's book, Climate Change is Class War. It really is, I think, a foundational text for reviving that kind of radical socialist politics. So anyways, enough for me, folks. We'll go over to the interview. Oops.
Sorry, I thought I was going to be able to...
No, we had a perfect, and then...
Well, so it's... I'll just, like, It's been, I don't know if you've been experiencing this, David, but like when you bring up the clips, there's been a little pause. So I was just trying to anticipate a little bit.
No, okay, I'm sorry. All right. Enjoy, friends. But first of all, Matt, thank you so much. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined as usual by one Matt, but in a special double feature, we're joined by another Matt, our good friend Matt Huber. Matt Huber is a regular guest on this program. We're a big fan of Matt's work. You can pick up their books, read their pieces in Jackman. We'll have a bunch of links below to read their work, including in Damage Magazine, which we might be able to talk about a little bit later. But first of all, Matt, thank you so much for joining us again on Left Reckoning.
I always love to join you guys. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be fun because we're going to talk about everybody's favorite subject, which is degrowth. But specifically, we wanted to talk about, there's a book that if you're on the left, if you spend any time on Twitter or I don't know, just in left-wing spaces, there's a book that's been getting a lot of buzz, or a couple books actually that have been getting a lot of buzz on the left, by the scholar Kohei Saito. I think that they're worth engaging with and talking about what's in them. And you, along with Lee Phillips, wrote a really great review in Jackman called Kohei Saito's Start from Scratch, Degrowth, Communism. Look, there's a lot, to sort of get into with this. We could talk about degrowth as like a general philosophy. I will say, if this is the first time you've seen us interview Matt Huber, I might suggest maybe watching some of those other videos that we've done on degrowth, because we do want to spend a little bit more time focusing on Saito's particular work instead of degrowth as a whole, though I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit in this video. But do just want to suggest people check those out. But I mean, so, this is a person who wrote a book that made it on the bestseller list, at least in Japan, got a lot of buzz, which is not something that you sort of expect, let alone with degrowth, but just with sort of like political economy. How would you sort of categorize, Saito's work? I mean, what is it that has drawn so much attention, to these books that he's put together?
Well, I think I have a theory that, degrowth is most popular in what could be called stagnant, non-growing economies. when my book came out, I went through, did a bunch of events in Europe, and, degrowth is huge over there. in sort of these economies that had a huge period of growth in the post-World War II era, but then hit this kind of, what some Marxists call a kind of long downturn in the 1970s, and then went into this kind of period of low growth and stagnation. I think this, and these are economies too that have been stuck in this kind of, focus on consumerism and mass consumption, that sort of residue of that post-war era. And so I think, in particularly in Japan, it's clear there's a hunger for kind of critiques of this sort of stagnant capitalist system, a critiques of consumerism. And there's a general sense that the people living in these kind of stagnant, so-called rich economies are, part of larger global processes that are leading to the massive ecological breakdown all around the world and climate change. And so I do think there's this kind of argument about degrowth and kind of slow, one of the books is called Slow Down. Like, this really appeals to a kind of, middle-class kind of consumer living in these kind of stagnant, industrialized economies like Japan.
Yeah. I want to get to some of the stuff about Marx in a minute, but I would gather that for most of our audience, the first question, is going to be about, degrowth as an idea, right? Is sort of, I think the best kind of argument for it, or the typical one that you'll see, is that there is a kind of natural limit, to the planet, right? To like life. Yeah. And we are basically under capitalism are running up, against that. And degrowthers are sort of present themselves as the people who are taking this seriously, while folks who are called quote unquote Prometheans or eco-modernists sort of are trying to sweep this under the rug. So before we get into like Saito and stuff, I mean, I just wanted to, you know, ask you sort of point blank, you know, are there limits, to life on this planet? Is that question fair in the way that it's kind of framed? I mean, you know, if you could just sort of speak to that very quickly so we can get into some of the other issues with degrowth.
Yeah, and to situate it, there's a whole history of scholars and thinkers who have sort of projected these fixed limits to growth and crucial kind of ecological limits to the capacity of societies to grow. So obviously this, before I get into this, I should say first off that yes, there are like clearly ecological limits. And we say that in the piece there, you know, humanity is always facing particular ecological constraints that are constraining what we can do on this planet and in society. And that's kind of got to be something that's always informing any kind of socialist approach to kind of taking control over production, planning. You want to plan in accordance with those real material constraints, and you can't escape them as much as you can develop technologies that can, negotiate them in different ways. So that being said, there's though this problematic history of like projecting these really fixed and rigid limits to growth. And that goes back to the political economist Thomas Malthus, who basically said that population growth is going to increase exponentially, but food production and land production can only increase in a linear fashion, and ultimately that population is going to outstrip our kind of fixed natural food production capacities. He made this argument to argue against welfare for the poor, because he thought if we help the poor, they'll just have more children and it'll make the problem worse. And so he was like very, it was a class argument against the poor, but it was, and then of course, in the wake of this argument, what did capitalism do? It just massively developed, as we'd say, developed the productive forces of agriculture that just shot through any kind of limits about food production that would worry us about in relation to population. So now, of course, there are 8 billion people on the planet, but we produce enough food to probably feed close to 10, 12 billion people. We have way more food production capacity than we know what to do with, yet we still in capitalism have all this hunger and poverty and scarcity that's completely social. So then fast forward to the 1960s. So Malthus wrote this essay in 1798 and revised it in the early 19th century. Then in the 1960s, you get the rise of the modern environmental movement, who sometimes is not using Malthus directly, but basically repackages these ideas of limits to growth. And obviously there was the Club of Rome that came out with this huge scientific report called The Limits to Growth. And this is in the context of the post-World War II era, where all our economic policy attention is focused on, you know, GDP growth, and this is seen as a barometer of the health of the economy. So it was sort of this ecological answer to this growth economy. And then you had more egregious kind of just blatantly racist versions of this, like Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, which basically, again, like Malthus himself, focused on where is population growing, poor developing countries, and then they're like about to ignite this bomb on the planet and we have to stop them. You know, he went to India and saw a bunch of people and it freaked him out, so he wrote a book about it. It's like literally like racist. And so you get this turn of kind of what people call neo-Malthusianism in the 1970s. And out of that comes a school of economists that call themselves ecological economists, who are really concerned about what they call the energetic limits to growth. They're really concerned about the fact that fossil fuels are finite and there's only so much of it and we're going to run out of it. And then, you know, this fossil fuel-based civilization is going to kind of reach these thermodynamic limits. Mm-hmm. All this stew of kind of limits to growth thinking has a through line that goes directly to the modern degrowth kind of ideology. A lot of the the people that are sort of the core scholars of degrowth are themselves ecological economists. They come out of this tradition that came out of the 1970s. And nowadays, though, the new science in vogue that people use is called the science of planetary boundaries, which has laid out sort of nine planetary boundaries around water use and nitrogen pollution and obviously climate change. And a lot of them, as you might say, are neither planetary nor strict boundaries. Like, it's very clear when you start to dive into this science, like, they choose a boundary for land use that I think, if I recall, something like 25% of like the terrestrial land bank or whatever is once that's get into use, then we've crossed this planetary boundary. But it's the scientists admit that 25% boundary is like arbitrary. They actually don't know exactly where the boundary is. This kind of science of planetary boundaries is now, and Saito, he just uses the science in the first chapters of Slow Down over and over again to show, mm-hmm. you know, these are the new, this is what the science is saying about the limits. And therefore our socialist project has to be, how do we reorganize production to respect these planetary boundaries? Now, I'm all for like reorganizing production to respect certain ecological constraints. And I think there's some very concerns about these boundaries, not the least climate change itself, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem I see and the through line I see way back to old Thomas Malthus is that they really are projecting these kind of fixed and intractable limits. And that, I think, puts these kind of shackles on our vision of what we can do. And for me, socialism is really about unshackling us from markets, from the profit motive, to kind of really unleash human potential and all this kind of stuff. The last thing I'll say, and I know I've gone on way too long, but I'm a scholar. I kind of made my way in academia being a scholar of oil. One thing I learned pretty early in my studies is that oil has this history of constantly these people coming out and being like, oh my God, we're running out of oil. Like literally in the 1920s, there were these sort of crank geologists who were like, no, I've looked at the numbers and we're about to reach the limits of our oil and we have to plan for. And of course, you know, the ecological economists from the 70s were all they started to inform this kind of peak oil theory. And a lot of their kind of projections about peak oil really pointed to the early 2000s when we're going to reach global peak oil. And this is when I was doing my dissertation, when basically peak oil mania was kind of going wild. And then, you know, unfortunately, capital is really good at finding oil when the price goes high. And capital just, you know, developed fracking and then found all this other oil all over the world. And there's still really, we haven't even began to unlock the potential of fracking on a global scale, which is kind of terrifying given mm-hmm. climate change. And so the point being that all these sort of efforts to always sort of project and predict where the hard lines and limits on these resources are not always so clear and not always successful in predicting those limits. And it's clear that they're not always so fixed and immutable. It's actually capitalism that's shown that more often than not, we shoot through these limits through technological changes and so forth.
So, I mean, like, I want to get to the Marxism aspect of this too, because, you know, this degrowth tradition and Saito in particular, like, claims Marx in a pretty shocking way that we'll get into in a second. But just like on this question of like fixed limits, I just want to put something to you. I mean, it's like a way to think about it too, is that, you know, it's like, what kind of limits are we talking about? So like in this, you know, in the sense, it's like, there is a limit on how much fossil fuel we can burn and maintain a certain environment, right? But that's a different thing from, you know, having air conditioning in a home, or having an electrified home, because there are different ways to, for example, produce electricity. Yes. So if you're operating from a mentality of saying, oh, you know, a certain lifestyle or way of living, which again is like, you know, so broad of a conception in the first place, like you have to sometimes get into the nuts and bolts of it, you know, can actually obscure that, like, oh, well, probably what we need to be doing is building out clean energy like solar, wind, nuclear power, and transitioning away from fossil fuels, for example, right? Like that's something that is like, you know, that's interacting with a limit And recognizing that there are certain kinds of limits without what the degrowth crowd tends to do, which is say, hey, there's a problem in modern production. And instead of sort of, I don't know, imagining ways to sort of use technology and resources and labor to overcome those, it's a kind of retreat. Oh, we will just stop, you know, heating, cooling our homes in the summer, heating them in the winter, et cetera. Right. I mean, is that fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely. And for whatever reason, again, it's funny, in my book, I have these different categories of professional class, climate political people, and I put the degrowthers in the, what I call the radical anti-system people. They're all about, like, capitalism's the problem. And, but the more I've been engaging with them, which has been way too long at this point, I realize they're actually quite deeply in this science communicator sort of personality I projected to, because they always are using, like, the science says planetary boundaries, thus we must do X. And what they say is the science of climate change means we must reduce our energy consumption, particularly in the global north, because that's just, if we're going to decarbonize fast enough, we have to reduce, right? But as you're saying, it's actually not really a quantitative question as much as a qualitative one. It's about qualitative transformation of the energy system as rapidly as possible toward these clean energy sources. And that, and once you do that, the question of how much consumption you can have still should be something we debate in terms of, you know, if we're socialists, like, you know, planning a good society, like, then people don't necessarily need massive houses and big, like, tank-like SUVs and stuff like that. But the question, you know, of climate change is really about this qualitative transformation. And, you know, one example I've been giving recently is it really, like, it depends, you know, your energy source really depends on whether or not it's clean or not, right? So in Quebec, they have, you know, almost 100% clean hydropower, which, before people get angry, I should point out, developing this hydropower has its own set of ecological consequences, land use problems. It's had struggles with certain indigenous groups, land claims in those areas. So that's, but from climate, purely climate change perspective, they, Quebec has this, like, totally decarbonized hydro-based energy system. Therefore, and I learned in Quebec, they really waste a lot of energy. They use resistance heating, electric heating, in a very cold part of the world. Like, they, all of them just use, like, electric heating because it's so cheap and they have so much of it. They have so much abundance that they just use it. And doing this doesn't really matter climate change wise because it's all clean, right? Now, another example, when I was in Europe, I was talking with a friend, and he was talking about how, you know, in the Eastern Bloc in Germany, when they were under, you know, communism, like, they did develop more collective forms of housing, more collective forms of transportation. So things we as socialists would actually like public housing, public transit, more efficient sharing of housing and transport resources. But the problem was that the Eastern Bloc was all powered by coal, right? So it was really dirty, really environmentally destructive. So even though they're being more efficient in the consumption side, they're having horrible environmental impacts. So really, you know, so whether or not you're efficient or wasteful on the consumption side really is contingent on what does the production look like. And that's what decarbonization really has to focus on, that we need to rapidly decarbonize that production system. And then, yeah, if we get more power over production, let's sort of have a collective debate over how much energy we need as a society, what is useful to power in our lives, and these types of questions. But the main thing is qualitative transformation of that energy system.
I mean, this is sort of what has always been my problem with degrowth, which is, I'm sympathetic, obviously, to the way of stating acutely the problems and the urgency of the situation, but it seems like a complete dumbness to the political realities. And, like, all this comes in an austerity era post great financial crisis, where if your main demand is we need less, yeah, like, the powers that be can be like, okay, I can deliver that easily. Like, we can just call this new stuff, this is, we're just degrowthing instead of austerity.
No. Yeah. I mean, you know, the degrowthers, will reply. They say, but no, we actually want to give, you know, people more. We want to give shorter working week. You know, I'm down with that. Let's degrow the working week, right? That's cool. But that's they do this thing where they kind of appropriate old socialist demands that have been socialist demands forever. Like they want more public services and public housing. Yeah, so did socialists in the 1920s. You're not really changing, but they have to situate these kind of more progressive and socialist types of demands that the working class would say this is beneficial. This is not austerity, right? But they have to couple this, because they have to call it degrowth, with an overarching focus on reductions, right? So the any sort of programmatic definition of degrowth is going to center a planned reduction of either energy use in the global north or material throughput on a global scale. Whatever it is, they have to sort of put their dig their heels in with this sort of overarching focus on aggregate reductions in energy and material use. And that's kind of the focus. But you're right, politically speaking, it allows it's very easy to kind of caricature this politics that centers less as a politics of less and as a kind of something very comfortable with austerity. I thought it was funny in her short-lived rule over the UK, Liz Truss came into power and she was promoting her own kind of austerity agenda, but she did so in a way that she said, I'm trying to take on what she called the anti-growth coalition. And so the way in which degrowth, just one thing, the way I've said it before is like, because capitalism has this kind of ideology of GDP growth and kind of this sort of, you know, degrowth is called growthism. We kind of worship this idea of growth and statistical GDP growth. Degrowth's kind of like on the ideological terrain of that capitalist ideology, and they just negate it, right? They say, we want the opposite of that. We want degrowth. But that plays right into the hands of the right and others who are able to caricature the left as sort of, again, like out of touch and not doesn't want growth, which, again, in an age of austerity where people literally have trouble paying for their bills, there's a cost of living crisis, people can't even get the basic necessities, to like this idea of no growth or degrowth doesn't make a lot of sense on the surface, right? And so it's a nice gift to the right to kind of hand them this sort of austerity sounding demand, right?
Yeah, and I feel the same. I make the same critique of things I'm even more sympathetic to than degrowth, which is defund the police and abolish ICE. Like, I think both of those things, I cynically kind of think it's to kind of get in more libertarians who are tax averse when it goes into that stuff. But they lack actual affirmative demand of what we want to process more people and invite them in, or we want a Green New Deal. Like, you have to make the affirmative demand. Otherwise, who's going to fill the vacuum? Like, who's actually in power right now?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I said, let's not put D in front of our demands. Let's try that. One time I looked up the prefix, you can search on like dictionary.com, and the prefix D, it says often means privation. Right? So it's like the very meaning of the prefix is like less and privation and want, right? So that's not good.
Well, let's jump a little bit into some of these claims about Marx. And I'll just say up top for folks, I know everybody comes into these with a little different understandings of some of these debates. Just so like folks are clear here, like Saito wrote an article in The Nation titled "The Green New Deal is the Opiate of the Masses," right? So if you're somebody who, you know, sort of had supported these kind of movements and you're not understanding why it is that us folks who have been very passionate and arguing for Green New Deal are frustrated with this growth of this new kind of movement, right? That might be a good example of it. But I really do want to make sure that we get some time in on this Marx stuff, because I think that it's like, these claims are wild to me, I will just say, as somebody who considers myself to be a Marxist. I would like it if we could maybe go one and two, right? Because he makes a bunch of claims in his work. But the large ones are that basically Marx abandons historical materialism. And then two, he becomes a degrowth communist. And Matt, I have to ask you, you know, where is the kind of evidence? I mean, where is this argument coming from? You could take them in order or holistically, however you like.
Yeah. And there's been other reviews before Lee and Mines came out that just bluntly says, like, there's one we quoted where it's like, frankly, there is no evidence for these claims. you know, it's so, yeah. And so he claims that, you know, Marx had this sort of Promethean kind of idea that of historical materialism, that capitalism develops the productive forces and develops technology to create kind of the preconditions for socialism. And so that I really think it's not controversial that Marx and Engels believe that capitalism plays a progressive role in history and in kind of, you know, centralizing production, making it more efficient, and also, you know, creating this class we call the proletariat that becomes capitalism's grave diggers. And but Saito kind of develops this idiosyncratic reading of Capital, Volume 1 particularly, that argues that Marx kind of abandons this idea about the progressive role of capitalism and about the role of the productive forces in creating the conditions for socialism. And so what he argues is that, and I think there is some truth to it, and it's clear to Marx's analysis that the productive forces developed under capitalism are a product of the social relations and class relations of capital. So he says that in all the productive forces developed under capitalism are in sort of tied to capital, right? Tied to the class rule of capital. You know, certain technologies are developed so they can better dominate labor in the production process. And yes, that Marx does make these points, but he takes that to mean that what this means is that that the productive forces are kind of like inherently capitalist and sort of stained with capital, and therefore we cannot make use of them in a post-capitalist socialist society. And he says that these productive forces are going to have to disappear altogether, and we're going to have to start from scratch in terms of developing new...
Saito is saying this, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Saito is saying that essentially because capital develops these productive forces, they're kind of inherently stained with these capitalist class social relations, and therefore that, you know, once we move beyond capitalism, we're going to have to, this is where the title comes from, start from scratch in many cases, develop wholly new technologies and so forth. And so this seems, again, just sort of like, how does that work? Like, you know, to me, it seems like so basic that historical materialism is really about understanding how societies sort of develop out of existing societies. Like the theory of how feudalism transitions into capitalism really tries to look at those social relations and how they build to different social relations. Mm-hmm. And so it's again a pretty dramatic and bold claim to say that Marx sort of abandons this idea about capitalism's progressive role, about the centrality of the productive forces to create the material conditions for socialism. So that's the first thing about historical
and it creates this kind of difficult problem for Saito that you and Lee Phillips sort of outlined in the piece. We're in like the degrowth kind of manifesto, the degrowth position does sort of want us to use certain kinds of technologies, you know, mm-hmm. certain ways. So, okay, well, if all the, you know, the technologies, you know, developed under capitalism have this like fundamental original sin or whatever, you know, then how do we sort of get through it? And the Saito sort of creates this thing. Tell me if I'm saying these wrong, but like open and locked technologies, you know, which, I don't know. It's like, I guess a clever way to get out of that problem, but it becomes fairly arbitrary in that like, oh, well, this one, I like this one, so it's open technology, and I don't like this one as much, so it's a locked technology. Yeah. And as y'all know, your piece was like, it's very kind of a classic example of degrowth in this kind of PMC position of like, oh, I've sort of decided which ones are good and which ones are bad, and we're not going to deal with society and democracy and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, I mean, much like the 1960s, 70s sort of environmentalists, they're kind of they're just hostile towards all sort of big industrial technologies, right? I mean, it's a reaction against industrialism or industrialization. But again, that is, so any sort of large scale factory, you know, we've talked on this podcast about electricity, like big centralized power plants, even, you know, obviously the his prime example of a bad locking technology are new big nuclear power plants because they're big centralized kind of large scale types of technologies. Of course, out of the 60s and 70s, everyone's sort of like, no, we can have like little sort of local small scale, renewable energies and small urban gardens. And we can kind of have these technologies that are more what they like to say, like convivial and like human centered. And that's all good. And there's certainly plenty of environmentalists who argue for this kind of small, beautiful, small scale technology. But that couldn't be further from what Marxism was arguing, which Marxism, I mean, very clearly over and over shows that what capital does is the words he uses, socializes production. Even though capital remains in control and privatizes the profits, they're actually making production more cooperative, more reliant on the social forces of science and technology, and more centralized, which is requiring like huge like armies of coordinated labor. And it's that socialization of production that Marx argued, and he wrote during the Industrial Revolution. So this sort of development of big centralized industrial production, for him, very clearly, like that, and particularly the way in which that production like developed labor-saving technology that made things more efficient, that made things more streamlined, like that created real conditions where we could harness those technologies, and I should say change them, right? We're not going to just take capitalist technologies, and people accuse me of just keeping everything as it is. No, we'll transform them, we'll repurpose them to harness their benefits toward social needs, toward social good. But the idea that we should just reject all this industrial technological development as sort of stained with capitalism, and we can move on to our good, happy, open technologies of small scale production is just it's quite interesting to go back to the Communist Manifesto, because Marx and Engels argued against what they called reactionary socialists, right? And the reactionary socialists were the ones that wanted to hold on to kind of small-scale production that had predated capitalism, small farms, small artisanal production. And they were like, no, you know, capitalism's creating a new future for us, and we're going to expropriate this really large-scale, productive, efficient, because you know what that's going to do? It's going to give us all a lot of free time. Saito like says, I want free time in my little degrowth communist future, but he has no sense that if you really want a society of free time, you have to have like really efficient technology to make that happen. Sorry.
No. I mean, like 100%. And I'll just say for folks, Matt and I have, Matt Leck and I have done the Gotha program and the Communist Manifesto on this program. They're up for free for everyone to watch. Y'all watch them. And like, we talk about this in depth, this aspect of Marxist thought, because it is absolutely critical, to Marxism. This idea of sort of seizing these productive powers of capitalism that, you know, is one of the fundamental contradictions of capitalism, is that we actually have these labor saving, technologies. We have the ability to produce so much, and without having to use as much labor, that we actually have the potential to shorten, you know, the amount of labor, you know, the amount of time that people spend working, that we actually can live in abundance. And this is why we need to overtake it. So when, you know, somebody is sort of rejecting that, that is a fundamental, attack, not just like on Marx, but saying that like Marx is sort of like turned their back on Marxism. Engels is also turned into a bit of a villain here in a kind of wild way. Y'all note that Engels excised natural from one line of Marx's writing, and this sort of creates the conditions for Saito to sort of just imply that Engels has been basically obscuring all of Marx's work to hide this. I mean, is that...
Yeah, so Engels, you know, translated Marx's notebooks into Volume 3. In Volume 3, there's this famous quote, which has become the one quote that inspires a whole school of ecological Marxism, where he talks about what he calls an irreparable rift between capitalist production and the soil's ability to replenish waste and all this kind of stuff. And in that quote, yeah, he excised the word natural ahead of the word metabolism in certain contexts. And Ingalls, or sorry, Saito uses this as evidence that Ingalls was like repressing Marx's ecological awakening in the 1870s and was trying to kind of downplay this. And even someone who I think for most of history has been quite aligned with Kohei Saito is John Bellamy Foster. He wrote a review, not a review, just an essay recently where he's just like, this doesn't really mean as much as Saito seems to think it means. Like just moving this one word doesn't mean that like him and Marx were drifting apart and like they were having all these different views. And I'm sure we'll get into it, but Saito argues Marx becomes a degrowth communist in the 1870s. And he also says that Engels wasn't aware of this. Engels was in the dark about this. And then eventually, like when there's evidence out there that Engels claims, you know, Engels said that Marx reviewed his publication that, you know, part of it became Socialism, Utopian, Scientific, but the bigger one is called Anti-During. And this is like a straightforwardly historical materialist, like, you know, like an industry's coming, we're going to harness it, abolish poverty, abolish class rule, it's going to be great. You know, Engels claims Marx reviewed all that, he agreed with it, he said it was... And then Saito just says, well, you know, you look into the notebooks and the letters and it's pretty not credible that Marx really did that. And Engels is lying and he tries to turn turn Engels into like, again, like a villain sort of liar who's repressing this ecological degrowth Marx that he doesn't want the world to know.
Well, and, you know, and it's also, you know, to be fair, it'd be very, I mean, look, I know all these Engels and Marx believed that the work that they were doing was changing the world, but let's not forget that, you know, Marx made a difference politically in Europe at that time, but nowhere near what he is to us today, right? You know, this was not somebody who was like at that and in his actual life, you know, somebody who was able to influence the world in the way that his writing ended up doing later. So it'd be very prescient, I guess, is what I'm saying, of Engels to be very worried about, you know, oh man, this text is going to be misinterpreted 100 years from now, so I better, you know, mess with this or that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, just generically, like, this is all cut, like, this sort of trivia about production, whether it's like translation stuff, like, that's interesting if it can be backed up with, like, a look at actually what the text was and the significance that's supposedly perverted on it. But beyond that, like, this is just nonsense.
Well, yeah. Ironically, like, Engels did more to popularize Marxism than Marx was able to do, because it's sad for good old Karl, because he passes away in 1883, and really in the 12 years between that and when Engels passes away in 1895, you know, Engels, he really like spreads the good word of Marxism far and wide, right? Like in its texts like Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific that were probably read way more by more labor parties, socialist parties, workers parties, and more workers that were struggling in those movements. We're reading these kind of more straightforward, to be honest, popularized versions of Marxism that Engels was able to really spread in those years. Some were also reading Capital, which is kind of the magnum opus, and it's got incredible analysis. But, you know, I think less we're reading that than we're reading what Engels was sort of using as kind of translations of Marxist ideas.
So, just in interest of time, I mean, unless there's something that you want to add, I feel like the Marx basically becoming a secret degrowth communist too, is a fairly similar aspect, you know, to the abandoning of historical materialism, where it's like hyper-focusing on, you know, a very small segment of Marx's work, a letter, if I'm, you know, getting that correct.
Some notebooks that he transcribed.
You know, and again, people should read the review to really get into this, because I want to talk about what this sort of means, right? In the review, there's links below. Please read it. But I mean, there's just two things. And one, you know both of them in the piece. It's like, well, one is, well, what does this mean? You know, if these things were true, which, you know, I think arguably it's like very clear that they're not. But what does this mean? I mean, it basically means that Marx turned their back on their work towards the end of their life. And then, well, what is Marxism, right? So, you know, what is the point in claiming this in the first place if you're basically saying that it doesn't, you know, speak the truth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it really invalidates the sort of most of the canon that we associate with Marxism, you know, like particularly the Communist Manifesto, which is such a brilliant mm-hmm. articulation of this sort of theory of history that they were developing at the time. And I myself would never want to say that, oh, that's the bad Promethean Marxism. I mean, there's so much. I really believe that a lot of the ideas in that document, they hung on to those till they died. I really believe that. You know, obviously they're always revising their thought and they're thinking through things differently. This letter to Versulich, you know, she's this Russian sort of more on the agrarian kind of populist side of the movement, who they were just trying to figure out, can Russia transition to communism without going through the capitalist industrial transformation themselves? And Marx said, yes, for sure. As long as you appropriate the benefits from capitalism that happen elsewhere. And he said, if there's a revolution in Western Europe, yes, Russia can then appropriate all the technology and the productive forces that capitalism needs to develop. And he makes these comments that, you know, you could learn from these communes, these sort of collective communes that were in Russia, these rural mirror kind of communal forms of agriculture, like those types of social relations could help inform your transition to communism. Mm-hmm. It was a nuanced kind of advice to this movement in Russia that said, like, really, you know, communism is about the emancipation of the global proletariat. And if you're sort of situated in the global proletarian revolution, you can benefit from that. But he says clearly in this letter that, these communes are going to have to be sort of transitioned into much more efficient and high technology of agriculture, and that, you know, it's only going to work if it's in conjunction with all the technology from the West, right? So unfortunately, Saito then reads this letter as sort of advocating for, because these communes are kind of static and developmentally sort of steady, he says that he's advocating for a kind of steady state economy, an economy mm-hmm. that is not growing, that is sort of circular, right? But that's just not really in the letter at all, and sort of bizarre. So
it is truly odd. and as somebody who's like, my academic background was in philosophy, I just have a real exhaustion with any kind of like secret or implicit meanings in text. But I wanted to ask in the last couple of minutes, because I think this is really important here, is in Saito's work in particular, but in Degrowth as a whole, I mean, there is this kind of tension with how it wants to interact with Marxism, because Marxism has a very clear subject, which is the working class, the proletariat. This degrowth communism gets into a lot of trouble when we start trying to figure out who it is that's supposed to take action. As you note in your piece, you know, Saito is a little bit unclear. It sounds to me a lot like the weird kind of post-Marxist stuff that we argue against a lot in this program too, where it's kind of like a movement of movements, or how could we do socialist politics without the working class, basically, is my perspective on it. But I mean, you know, who is the subject here? I mean, you know, is that something that is sort of an afterthought? What is going on with this addition to supposedly, like, Marx is converting away from his own philosophy to this degrowth communism? I mean, who ends up becoming the subject of history in this, you know, telling?
If there is a subject, in the book that sold so well, 500,000 copies, Slow Down, the working class is literally mentioned 4 times, like, it never in any central way. So literally, like, from both books, really, the working class or the role of the proletariat in ushering, it's just not even acknowledged or dealt with. It's just not mm-hmm. even on the table, right? He did a interview recently for New Left Review where he talked about giving up his naive ideas of working class politics. So that might be, you know, I've been trained in academia, and you learn very early in academia that, cool, you can do Marxism. Yeah, we love Marxism because we love to critique capitalism because we don't like capitalism. But give up this idea of working class, agency, and kind of these old ideas of, you know, seizing factories, and that's seen as mm-hmm. sort of old problematic Marxism. We're going to leave that aside. So for him, like, there's just a lot of vague gestures to, obviously, the if there's any agent in the book, it's the global South, right? It's like sort of the global South of oppressed peoples are going to kind of rise up and revolt against this sort of destructive ecological system. But he also really spends a lot of time like celebrating sort of small scale ecological movements in cities, like, you know, taking control over food production in urban gardens, taking, you know, developing public housing, some things that are sort of under the rubric of what's called ecological municipalism, sort of like small sort of cooperatives. Oh, he really is into worker cooperatives. He's really into, which is very standard for degrowth, sort of celebrating peasant movements and Via Campesina to take control over their own land and sovereignty and food sovereignty, which I think anyone should support, but doesn't necessarily solve the problems of how we deal with the, you know, 6 billion people who've been pushed off the land and are proletarianized and reliant on commodities for survival. And that's sort of what Marx was referring to as the proletariat majority that's sort of been forced to rely on markets and money for survival, and that was his agent of change. And so, in the chapter which lays out his sort of political theories, there's a lot of like these buzzwords like creating autonomous zones, creating horizontal solidarity. You know, it sounds like a lot of the kind of buzzwords of Occupy and, the World Social Forum and the kind of this sort of thing that, you know, it felt like for me, and I'm sure you guys agree that in the kind of last decade, it felt like we were at least sort of moving away from that kind of horizontalist kind of, but it's very present in this analysis.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that is so funny, I mean, at least to me, is that like in practice, I think the, you know, what I would call, you know, like, this like post-Marxism, stuff very inspired by Laclau and Mouffe, sort of got us as trial run, particularly with like Podemos in Spain. And we saw it, that kind of left populism lose. And there's something very odd about degrowth where a lot of its political strategy does just seem to be, let's do the 2010s again, but with an even less popular slogan.
I mean, there sometimes it just feels like anarchism, like and there's this one footnote where he quotes someone's idea of sort of anarchist communism and endorses that he says, that's what I mean when I say degrowth communism, I mean anarchist communism, in particularly in relation to the Paris Commune. There are other times where he sort of denounces anarchism, but to me, a lot of this kind of like small scale horizontalist solutions, you know, there's no theory of the state or how you would actually achieve state power in any of this analysis. He doesn't, like I said, he doesn't mention unions or the trade union movement. So to me, it feels very akin to anarchism and kind of small scale sort of horizontalist solutions. And then the question becomes, okay, if you're promoting this kind of anarchist politics, why are you so hitching your wagon to Marxism? Like, why is Marx the big prophet for your whole analysis? And then I think, honestly, it's because in academia, like, there's a lot of interest in Marx, right? Like, you know, Marx is kind of very fascinating. There's and to his credit, Saito has like done a lot of archival research on Marx's letters and Marx's notebooks, and there's just a huge world out there of Marxology and Marx studies, and I think he's really invested in that world, and unfortunately he's trying to kind of take that world of Marxism and contort it into this kind of anarchist degrowth small scale politics, and that doesn't quite fit.
Yeah, I mean, it is truly odd, I will just say. But Matt, I always appreciate speaking with you. There's a link below for people to read this review. Folks really should. It goes a lot more in depth than we were able to in this interview, co-written with Lee Phillips, of course. There's a link to that. We should always pick up Matt's book, Climate Changes Class War. I know there's a lot going on, though. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug or direct folks to?
Well, Fred Stafford and me had our latest analysis on electricity politics out in the second print issue of Damage magazine. It's called The Utility of Utilities, which Much of the villain of the climate left these days are utilities, and they are often quite corrupt and dastardly when it comes to climate change politics. But we try to argue that, unfortunately, the critique of utilities has led to a lot of the sort of deregulation and marketization of the electricity sector, and that really kind of revisiting this idea that utilities grew out of, which is that electricity is kind of a public utility. It's an essential service. It must be kind of regulated with the public interest in mind. Like these ideas we don't want to sort of throw out with the bathwater, right? So, and particularly in this era of decarbonization where we know we're going to have to grow our electricity generation so dramatically to deal with electrifying everything and all this stuff, like utilities were actually really good at historically at growing the electricity system, building a lot of new infrastructure. So anyway, yeah, please subscribe to Damage Magazine. They're doing lots of great stuff, and check that out.
Yeah, absolutely. Please do subscribe to Damage Magazine. And as always, Matt, great talking with you. Hope to have you on again soon.
Thanks so much.
Just a nice uncontroversial chat there. Nice to talk with Matt once again.
I mean, I will admit I am always amazed at how controversial it seems to be. And to throw a little gasoline on the fire, I have to say, I think a lot of people get really worked up about it. How many people who are going to get worked up about this conversation think that Marx turned his back on historical materialism or secretly became a degrowth communist? I don't know. I think sometimes it's worth sort of understanding where you stand instead of just getting mad. But if you want to hear us talk and chat and hang out a little bit more, we're going to be going over to the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Get access to that. We'll be taking some questions from the audience. So if you want to get in there?
Some fun things. Richard Dawkins is a Christian now. We'll talk about that. And also, you know these Amazon stores, the Fresh and Go, Fresh, whatever.
The Fresh and Go, yep.
The Take Fruit store that used AI. AI turns out to be like a guy in India looking at security camera footage to see what you put in your
basket. Oh my God, that's actually really awesome.
turns out. So yeah, we'll be talking about that. Patreon.com/leftreckoning to join us in about 20 minutes.
Sounds good, friends. See you there.
Nice delay before the videos lit up. There we go.